Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that's changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, Beautiful Thing, John Waters, and Jean Genet. Last week I spoke with Ben Miller of the Bad Gays book and podcast. This week I'm talking to his co-host and co-author, Hugh Lemmy, a writer whose work investigates the disgusting. It's an unlikely fascination, one born out of the attitudes that he heard expressed about queer people when he was growing up. And now, in looking at the realities of human life from its best to its worst, Hugh's writing has evolved from asking whether people can be lovable despite being gross, to whether they are lovable because they are gross. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a couple quick reminders, starting with a heads up that I've got a new video coming your way this weekend on YouTube. This one's about the behind-the-scenes making of the film Some Like It Hot. Join me Sunday at 11 a.m. Pacific at youtube.com/mattbaume for a live stream and then the premiere of the video. And I hope you'll join me for weekly live streams over on Twitch. Every Sunday afternoon, we watch and talk about classic episodes of television, great movies, and occasionally old commercials that just have a way of sticking with you. That's at twitch.tv/mattbaume. And if you haven't yet, take a look at my new book about the history of queer characters on sitcoms, Hi Honey, I'm Homo. It's available now wherever books are sold. It's the book that Dan Savage called a triumph and said, everyone should read this book. So you should. Go to gaysitcoms.com to get a copy and request a personalized signature. Big thanks to everybody who makes my work possible on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/mattbaume to support the Sewers of Paris and get patron-exclusive benefits. Now, here's my conversation with Hugh. Well, this week I'm speaking with Hugh Lemmy. He's a novelist, artist, a filmmaker. He's co-host of the Bad Gays podcast. Hugh, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me on.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, I think the one film that really changed my life would be It's a Beautiful Thing, the 1996 sort of British romantic comedy-ish drama by Hetty MacDonald. It's a really beautiful, sweet, very sort of quiet film in a way, but very touching, about these two 16-year-old boys who live on Thamesmead, which is a housing estate in South London, a very working-class area. And it's a sort of story about how they come to realise, I guess, that they're gay and that they fall in love. And it features this sort of cast of really interesting characters around them, this teenage neighbor, a young black woman who's obsessed with Mama Cass. And so the whole film is soundtracked by Mamas and Papas, which is really beautiful in its own right. But when you sort of play it off against this landscape of this like brutalist post-war housing estate, it's very, very tender. And then like an amazing performance for Jamie's mom, Sandra, by this British actress who's more famous as like a soap actress now, called Linda Henry, who plays this really tough, hard-bitten pub landlady, single mother who's kind of like doesn't take any shit and has seen it all, but has like a heart of gold underneath.
So where were you when you first saw it?
I think I first saw it in 1997, so I'd have been like 11, maybe 12 when I first saw it. And my mum showed it to me. I was born in this town called Barrow in Furness, which is like a shipbuilding town at the end of this very isolated like rural peninsula in the north of England. And I grew up on the sort of peninsula that leads out to it. So like a very rural area with this huge industry that actually closed down when I was a kid.
Wait, the industry or the town?
The industry. But when the industry closed down, like the town, like, I mean, the town's been in population decline ever since. I think at the time there was about 70,000 people who lived there, and 15,000 of those worked in a shipyard. And at the end of the Cold War, obviously they just didn't need, you know, all the government contracts for these huge military vessels closed down. So they shrank the shipyard from about 15,000 to I think about 4,000 people, and they just started making nuclear submarines there. It was quite a sort of desolate atmosphere, I guess. And my mum worked in that town as for the council. She worked in child protection, looking after, sort of trying to help children who are like victims of childhood sexual abuse and abuse in the home and stuff. Around that time, she got a promotion. I think she maybe even moved jobs. She was sort of retraining. And to celebrate, she borrowed a VHS player from a neighbour. So we watched, I don't know, I think we watched Mrs. Doubtfire and a bunch of his other films. And then one night she showed me this film, A Beautiful Thing. And it's funny because like in retrospect, I kind of wonder, like, did she know at that point, trying to like tell me that okay, was she genuinely interested in it herself? You know, like it's kind of to do with these kids who live in this kind of rough environment where they're victims of abuse themselves. So I never really got to the bottom of that, but it hit just at that moment where I was definitely becoming aware of my sexuality and acting on it and stuff. And I remember watching it and having this like very particular vision of what it might mean to be gay, I guess, and the struggles of it.
Was that like the
And
first time you'd seen an open depiction of a gay couple, or like what kind of depiction or representation had you had up to that point?
yeah, very little, very little. I mean, when I came out as gay, I was the only gay person I'd ever met, the only openly gay person I'd ever met. You know, I was the first gay person I met myself. I had never met anyone gay before that. So I guess my understanding of it all came from media anyway. The stuff I was seeing on the media was, you know, late 90s. There was, you know, four TV channels in the UK at that point, on terrestrial. And I don't think we had the internet yet either. So it was very much what you were just getting off TV, which was still at that point a pretty negative portrayal of gay people. And if there were positive portrayals of gay people, they were really struggling against that mainstream. So I guess it was George Michael, who I was kind of aware of around that time when he was sort of outed and the way he behaved. And then people like Graham Norton and stuff, who I've got a lot of time for, but it's just a very few people that I'd have seen on screen at that point.
And I imagine, like, in the town where you're growing up, I'm relying entirely on stereotypes here to say this, but it seems like the kind of environment where there were not a lot of opportunities for a young queer child.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't actually living in Barrow at that time. We'd sort of moved out to a town sort of in the Lake District. So it was very rural and very isolated, very beautiful area, lots of mountains and lakes and things. But there really wasn't anywhere to go, any way to get out, really. You know, it was a couple of hours drive even at that point to get to Manchester, I guess, or Newcastle or Glasgow. So yeah, I just didn't really have any framework for understanding, I guess, what my sexuality was. And I think my mum was extremely worldly. You know, she'd worked in this pretty rough area of child protection, and seen a lot of things in her life. So I kind of wonder whether that was her trying to sort of give me an option, even if I didn't want to take it.
It seems like A Beautiful Thing is not super uplifting. Like it doesn't end. It ends on a song, but I wouldn't say that it's like, everybody's parading down the street. So, what was your take? Like, did it make you feel, I don't know, happy about who you were, or concerned, or like, how did you receive it?
Well, I think first of all, it stuck in my mind because it turned me on. You know, there's these two young guys. I mean, at that point, they were all like maybe 4 or 5 years older than me, who were sort of cute and into each other. And you know, I saw them sort of kissing and, you know, massaging each other or whatever. And I was like, oh, this is something I'd like to watch again, I guess. I do think actually, like, you know, it's not a super uplifting ending, but they do find each other and stick with each other. And I think it's really interesting as like a artifact within sort of British gay culture, because so much of representations of gay guys on in British gay culture, especially in novels and stuff, they're kind of about this like class escape, this class-based escape where you come out and it's difficult, but then you can kind of leave. You know, you leave to the city, or you go to university and you rise through a class system. You look back on these on your roots as this like difficult time. And I think one thing that's really beautiful about the film is that doesn't happen. They stay where they are, and it's not this like miraculous escape. It's just like, yeah, you just have to learn to be yourself and love who you love within the world that you're in, I guess. So that kind of like message, it's like it's not uplifting in a utopian way, but perhaps there's something more positive and uplifting, because it's like, well, you might not get away, but you can still be happy, or you can still find, you know, find people. But for me, I mean, as soon as I did come out, which was like a year or two later, I definitely was all about getting away.
Where did you want to get away to?
London. Yeah, just London. Like, I remember, yeah, it was a very difficult time for me, my teenage years in general. When I came out, I was actually outed at school. I'd sort of told a girl in my class who I was sort of thought was a friend, and it was too good a gossip, I think, for her not to share. And I just sort of went for it straight away. I was like, well, as soon as people started asking me, I was like, yeah, I am. And I never felt that much difficulty or shame or conflict internally about that, which I think again comes from my mom and that's her sort of who she was as a person, I guess. But around that time, maybe just a year or so after she'd shown me that film, she was diagnosed with motor neuron disease, which is, I think in America it's called like ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, which is this very unpleasant degenerative neurological illness where you basically your muscles stop responding to the nervous signals. So you basically very, very slowly become paralyzed, and it's a very barbaric disease that sort of creeps through your entire body, and there's no cure, and there's very little they can do about it. You just have to care for the person who's getting it. So I spent most of my teenage years in this very difficult situation of, in some ways, looking after my mum. All the emphasis in my life was sort of on the fact that my mum was quite slowly dying, and then I had this very intimate, difficult, loving relationship with her, I guess, because I was aware the entire time that she was dying and what my role had to be within her death, I guess. Yeah, it was difficult.
Jeez, yeah, that must have been a tremendous amount of pressure.
Yeah, it was a tremendous amount of pressure. It was difficult because I was, when I came out at school, like I said, I was the only gay person I knew, and that was definitely the case at school. I don't think there's any openly gay people the entire time I was at school, either on staff or other students. So I was quite badly bullied while I was at school. But then I'd sort of come home and I couldn't really bring any of that back into the house because there was this other crisis happening. And I think my role with my mum was kind of to be the continuity of life, you know, like everyone else was sort of concerned with her illness and her care and things. And I was the one who was supposed to like give a bit of optimism for her that things would continue after her death. So I had to sort of keep a lot of that to myself. But just as a result, I mean, I'd sort of, yeah, I kind of didn't go out much with friends and stuff because I'd wanted to be at home with her in after school and things. So I'd go back home, and then there was all these sort of changing roster of these carers, these women who had come and sort of, you know, help her get to bed or go, use a bathroom or eat and stuff. And my dad started to spend more and more time away, and left eventually. So I was kind of like this one continuity figure. But the strange thing about it was that no one told me at all what was happening, like at any point, or he asked about me, I think, either. Yeah, I had one conversation with my dad, which was very explicit, which he stopped one day by the side of the road, I guess when I was about 12 or something, and said, "This is what's happening. You know, your mum's got this disease. She's not going to get better. She's only going to get worse, and she'll die." And the prognosis at that point, after her diagnosis, was maybe a year. It's a pretty quick disease in the way it takes over, but she lived for about another 4 or 5 years. So I think everyone's had their head set on the fact that she'd live for a year or 2 years, and when it took longer, people were not really prepared to deal with it. So they were all sort of coping in their own way, but no one really sort of checked in on me at school or even at home, really. So I sort of, yeah, had this thing. And the only person I did kind of really could talk to, not about her illness because she didn't want to talk about it, but about anything else, was my mum. So we became very close. I'd come home and I'd talk to her about the bullying, and I'd talk to her about, you know, when I came out to her and stuff. But there was a lot of weight there, I guess. Yeah. And as part of that, I think she was very much trying from a very, I think she made a decision that she only had a few years to teach me some really important life lessons. So I think this film is kind of a bit like that, you know, like, okay, like I'm gonna give you this space to talk about this. And then, yeah, later on, she was a very wise, sort of thoughtful person, and thought a lot about conflict and things. So she gave me some things that were kind of quite hard lessons, I guess, to learn when you're 14 or 15, but she only had one chance really to tell me them. So yeah, but as a result, I think, yeah, like my interest at that time really became around like the sort of kind of this my interest became around, and it's quite hard to talk about, but I guess about like coming to terms with kind of being a disgusting person. Because that's a lot of the messages I was getting, you know, like and so my interest in culture really emerged at that point as like, yeah, like a real interest in like the abject, and the strange as a queer person.
Well, I mean, tell me about that. Like, it's a really frank way to describe it, becoming a disgusting person or being a disgusting person. Like, I guess is that the message that you were receiving from media is like, oh, you're gay, therefore there's something wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was still the overarching message at that time. Like, if you go back and read newspaper headlines and stuff, it was still pretty normal to discuss gay people in those terms. Although things were starting to change to the culture we see more today. I think it's strange because I think a lot of queer people, when they're sort of struggling with their gender and sexuality, they get a lot of messages about shame and about humiliation and things like this. But I think, because my mum was very, very hard-headed as well, kind of like the figure in the film, the mother in the film, not quite so tough, but she was, yeah, very. For example, her father as well was kind of similar. They were both Quakers. I was like raised as a Quaker, so they had this quite strong moral compass, I guess. My grandfather, for example, he didn't fight in the Second World War. He was a conscience objector, and he actually was sort of sent to a camp because he wouldn't fight. He was put into a labor camp and things. There was always this thing in our family that you just stand by exactly. You say what you think and you think what you say, and you know you stand exactly by those things. So I never had that shame when I came out. I was like, oh no, I know that I'm gay. I'm not ashamed of who I am because I know in my heart that it's an okay thing to be. But that doesn't actually stop you dealing with the way other people treat you. So it's this strange thing of thinking like I'm an okay person, but I know that everyone else regards me as something disgusting that they can't really be around or be friends with. It's not quite the same thing as shame, you know, because I don't feel it myself, but I was just aware of it as a social pressure on me.
Well, I can imagine why getting out of that environment, why London must have seemed like a place where, I don't know, you had either more opportunity or could be a different person.
I just kind of knew that, that I'd find people there who I could be friends with. But I was also quite lucky at the time because I'd grown up in this valley for until I was about 7 or 8, and my neighbor in that valley was about the same age as me, and I stayed friends with him. But he went to a different secondary school, so at the weekend I sort of had this other friend who I could go and see who wasn't part of that same world, and he was also queer, I guess, in a very broad sort of way. So I'd go and spend the weekends with him, and his mum was doing an open university course. It's kind of like a way of getting a qualification in the UK where you it's like by correspondence, and you can get, you know, up to a doctorate, I think, but while still living at home and things. And she was doing a course on, I think it was on like gender, sexuality and film. And she was just an absolute obsessive film watcher, and their house was just stacked every wall with VHSs, and she had amazing taste. So she sort of gave us both this education when we sort of became teenagers, where I'd go over at the weekend and she'd put three or four films on. They'd be just incredible, sort of a lot of John Waters, for example, and Kenneth Anger. And I remember she got a DVD of Pink Narcissus, I think the year it was re-released, and sort of showed it to us as like 15-year-old boys. So that was like a place that was really an escape for me, this house where I could just be myself and get this education in queer film that was just incredible. And you know, obviously like John Waters is just someone who really understands the concept of like the abject, the disgusting in society, and turns that around on its head as like a queer movement, I guess.
Were there particular highlights, like were there moments that stuck with you or images from those films?
I mean, Pink Narcissus, there's the scene of the piss queen like lying in a trough, just the whole film is just absolutely incredible. I just love that film. And then yeah, a lot of John Waters, like just being taken straight away with the humor of seeing all these people who were kind of felt like part of my world in terms of also being sort of gross, disgusting queer people, and the power that they had from being that was really exciting to me. And we created our own little social scene, I guess, at his house. Sort of all the queers from the county, no matter, we were like a real ragtag bunch. Just if you were a teenager and you were sort of a queer or a goth or something, you just sort of end up at Phil's house. And yeah, met my first boyfriends there and stuff. And yeah, like we were just a crazy group of, I don't know, there was like a hairdresser, a guy who looked after his mum's horses, just a ballroom dancer in training, all these sort of people, just hanging out watching movies.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I love that. I guess you kind of generated a subculture that worked for you.
Yeah, we had a lot of shared interests and stuff. And one of the films that I became really obsessed with at that time, and got on VHS myself and was watching over and over again, was Velvet Goldmine, Todd Haynes's film. That really spoke to me as well as.
Did that inform your desire to become a filmmaker and an artist? Like, is that where that came out of, like, oh, I'm finding meaning in this stuff, and I'm finding, I can relate to people through this stuff. I want to make my own.
Yeah, I think so. My mum was pretty hard-headed, as I said, and one of her things was always like, it's good to have a creative hobby, but you've got to have a job that you can fall back on. So with my two elder brothers who had both left for university by the time she died, she was very much sort of, you know, you've got to get a proper job. But with me, there kind of came a point where everything kind of broke down, and I didn't really have much oversight at all. I could kind of do what I wanted in a lot of ways, and part of that was that I really threw myself into sort of doing theatre arts, and I couldn't really go to the do sports, do PE or anything. So I sort of just went to the art room then, and I was really focused on that. So I made some very bad decisions educationally in my choices of what I was going to study when I was at school, and which I think if she had been in better health, she wouldn't have allowed me to make. That was part of it, I think. And really, yeah, just wanting to get away. So she died when I was 17. It was like a very difficult sort of period. And again, like no one really sort of asked how I was or what was going on. So I just sort of did my qualifications pretty badly and got off to art school as soon as I could.
I can imagine art may have presented an opportunity to sort of work through that. If nobody was talking to you and nobody was like checking in on you, I wonder if the art that you were learning to make was, I don't know, your way of expressing how you were feeling.
Yeah, I don't think any of it exists now, but I can remember what a lot of it looked like, and it was very dark, as you might expect. That a lot of I was really into printing, a lot of sort of lino prints of myself. But in this, I was really into German expressionism, so that was a lot of dark, embodied sort of macabre, gothy
Sure.
sort of things going on. But yeah, I guess it was a place that I could say stuff and at least see my own thoughts reflected back to me, rather than to other people. It was very much like that. I wasn't really making it to sort of scream out to the world, this is how I feel, but more making it to then look at myself and say, okay, this is how I feel about things. And it wasn't something I could really tell to other people because they all had their own stuff going on. But it was tough. And again, it was quite embodies the illness. The illness is such a physical illness. To see someone kind of losing their ability to do things in front of you is pretty horrible. And I remember later on, we lived in this little bungalow. My room was right next to my mum's, and sort of, I remember being kept awake by the sound of these sort of machines that were, clearing her airways or filling her lungs right towards the end. And I was just sort of, it was just me next door, I guess, sort of sleeping, or not sleeping, as it were. And I made a lot of art then, sort of getting up in the night and drawing and painting and things. And so after she died, that was a difficult few years when I was sort of living with my dad's, and then I got to art school, and there was a sort of centrifugal force of the illness that I was spinning around the whole time in this world, and as soon as I sort of got free of the orbit, I sort of pinged off at a million miles an hour into London and just tried to get on with my life, which I think was the right thing to do, but I didn't really go through a mourning process after she died. I just sort of suppressed that. So it took a long time for me to get back to the point where my art and things started to think again about some of those more embodied and deviant aspects.
Well, so tell me about that. Like you said, that got you to London, going to art school. And so, what was the life that you found there? Like, and how did it meet your expectations?
It was amazing. I went to an art school called Goldsmiths, which has. It has a good reputation for art in some ways, but it has a kind of bad cultural reputation as kind of a very pretentious, annoying place, and a lot of critiques around the art school and stuff. But for me, it was just, I don't know, it was just incredible to find all these very strange people who just wanted to talk about art and culture and film and books and stuff that I could argue with about it and just make. I just made so much work while I was at art school. And yeah, like nightlife and not boys actually. I sort of was still a bit fucked up about that stuff. So I think so. It took me a few years to get into sort of guys again and figuring out what I wanted there. But I loved it.
Was London the kind of place where you're like, okay, this is where I belong. This was the right decision to want to come out here?
Yeah, 100%. The anonymity, I think, I was really into. Not being known or identifiable, I guess there. I got lost a bit as well. It took a few years to sort of begin the process of thinking about things and mourning mum and stuff. And so I think the way it sort of manifests itself was quite bad depression throughout that time. And I was sort of flip-flopping between sort of these really pushing myself to get out there and meet people and stuff. And then, some long weeks or months spent in bed. But also, yeah, finding this culture and these cultural references and people who just want to talk about this stuff and, a film library at the university of just thousands of DVDs and Yeah, so I met a lot of friends there who were interested in similar sort of things, and was going, like, I don't know, I was in a band for a while and sort of just experimenting. And then a bunch of us moved into this warehouse in the north of London that we sort of turned into shared studios, a little space, like a shared kitchen and things, and lived there. And yeah, met a lot of people and had some really good conversations and stuff. But I sort of dropped doing the art eventually because I just became far more interested in writing and the possibilities of writing. I think at one point I realized I had all these press releases that I was writing for art shows that I was going to do, but I hadn't actually made any art for them. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm just interested in writing these press releases.
Sure.
So yeah, so and it's a lot cheaper to be a writer than it is to be an artist. So yeah, that's how I sort of got into writing.
Tell me about that. Like, yeah, obviously press releases are one thing, but what kind of writing did you find yourself, I guess, drawn to?
I guess writing was a chance for me to go back and start to deal with the stuff that I was really interested in as a teenager, and these complex sort of feelings around weirdness and disgust and things. So, I wrote my first couple of novels were like very extremely sort of violent, pornographic, sexy satires on politics in the UK. Stuff that's normally extremely boring, like internal Labour Party politics and these sort of things, and yeah, they're sort of very psychedelic visions of alternative realities around that of people getting fisted and getting eaten by other guys' arseholes, and people fucking getting spit roasted by two guys who turn into real giant pigs and things like this. That's I'm kind of interested again, like, yeah, I guess in like the weirdness of what it means to be. To feel disgusting and how you deal with feeling disgusting and the power that comes with feeling disgusting. And I at that time I just became really, really into to Genet. Like Genet was, I guess, one of the main writers who I think gave me, maybe it sounds a bit much to say save me, but I just think gave me a way to think about these things. I think Genet's really powerful. He deals with the disgust of bodies and of being considered to be abject by other people by sort of eroticizing it, but not in a sort of simple way of like I'm a slut and I love being a slut, but more like there's actually a sort of deep moral power that comes from being regarded as disgusting and outside and other, and actually what can you turn that into as like as a motor for your way of living in a world of like conflict and hatred and stuff. He switches between this like disgust and the divine like a dizzying speeds, and as such like turns each into the other, I guess.
I think John Waters is probably the closest American version of that, or at least the most familiar one that I can think of. Just like reveling in the, I'm thinking specifically of like, a movie that is entirely about people who are competing to be the filthiest people in the world. Like, that is such a clear fascination and interest and I don't know, rewarding of being gross. Genet, when I think of his work, I think of something a lot more poetic. That I, not that John Waters isn't a form of poetry, but I don't know. I think of it a little more. I don't know. High-minded? Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, that's fair enough. I think he's dealing with the real big, deep questions of human existence in that way. But equally as weird and fun, I think. There's this great bit in A Thief's Journal where he's been arrested for being a rent boy on the streets of Barcelona. And this is, I mean, according to his telling a true story, in the sort of early 1930s, and the cops have dragged him into their jail, and he can hear them in the next room laughing at him because when they searched him, they confiscate from him like a half used tube of Vaseline, which is obviously for him to get fucked with. But it's like it's not a full tube, but it's something about the fact it's a half used tube, that like it symbolizes the fact that he has been fucked and stuff. And he like rather than being dejected by this, he like really revels in this sort of position. It's kind of like a sainthood or a martyrdom or something. He revels in this like this position of being like the most disgusting thing as like a yeah point of principle. And it's I think for me it's really telling that he's like one of the great anti-nationalists as well of the 20th century of 20th century literature. He's really against all power and nationhood and the idea of things being neat and whole and perfect and things like this. And he's like, no, we are like this, like we are these things that eat and shit and fuck and bleed and things. This is who we are as creatures. And that is kind of where our power and joy comes in. It doesn't come from being nice, clean, neat people in boxes. It comes from being these sort of creatures. I think at one point he discusses, like, he says that God is located in his bowels. Thanks a minute. It's just amazing, yeah.
I can see why your interest in folks like this and that idea informs the podcast and the book.
Yeah, I think so, because the neat categories are just, I think in terms of, yeah, the being bad gays and stuff, like the neat categories, the idea that there are the elect, the people who are good and the people who are bad, is even when it's on our side, it doesn't really work for me. Like the heroes don't really work for me. I think there's always within that the potential for something pretty unpleasant and bullying. And while other people we feature in the book, like they are terrible people, I think it's always interesting to sort of discuss their lives to try and understand how that came about. Not to justify them, but just to see them in context as human beings and allow ourselves to escape the pressure of having to be heroes as well. We are flawed and we do make mistakes and hurt people and stuff. And that doesn't make us disgusting, and doesn't make us someone who can't be part of society, who can't, we're not damaged forever because of this. We live in these complex things, these complex ways of being. Like we are living, breathing, shitting people, and we make mistakes.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I just listened to your episode about Benedetta Carlini. Am I saying her name right? So, this is a historical figure who, the record is complex about what she did and under what circumstances she did it. But all of the people that you discuss in the book and on the podcast, are folks who you could look at as having done some bad things, but the homosexuality itself is not the bad part. Essentially, it's the same-sex desire or the gender nonconformity, whatever they've done. Like, we can look at them as like, oh, goodness gracious, you're terrible, but not because of who you loved.
We do put that disclaimer in the start of the book. I think that both Ben and I are homosexuals, so we're not coming at this from a homophobic point of view. But also not entirely, I'd say that sometimes, like, the way they understood and acted on their sexuality kind of does make them bad guys or bad people. Like someone like Ernst Röhm, the first openly gay politician in the world, who was also the leader of the SA, Hitler's Brown Shirts. His sexuality was kind of deeply tied in with his homosexuality was really deeply tied in with his fascism, his idea that men loving men was a sort of superior form of warriordom, that women were disgusting and abject, and men were clean and pure warriors and beautiful like this. Like, there are fucked up ways to be gay and to, yeah.
Yeah, and I think I'm sure you must hear this a lot of queer people who are like, please don't. We don't want to claim those people.
Tough luck.
Yeah.
That's interesting though, isn't it? 'Cause it's kind of what I was saying about nationalism and Janae and stuff. It's like, well, you want a community, but you don't want the bad people in the community. You want to force them out. And it's like, ah, this is starting to sound a bit fucked up to me. Like, why, if you're a community, then these people are part of that community or not. But yeah, I think what's interesting about it is that there's so much in their lives that explain why contemporary homosexuality, at least in Europe and America, is the way it is. Even our heroes have a lot to be desired in the way that they sort of helped formulate gay identity and culture. So, you've got to take the rough of the smooth. And if we're going to have an honest conversation, we should have it. And I really do think that the conversations about bad people, about people who might not be heroes, people we'd have difficulty reclaiming, we have to have those conversations as queer people, because especially at the moment, if we don't have those conversations where we can discuss openly and critically and thoughtfully, what it means, what those lives meant, then we're kind of leaving that territory to people who do think we're disgusting and abject and want to destroy us. So yeah, we have to have those conversations first, otherwise we're leaving that ground to other people to claim.
Is it possible to think of queer people and sort of a continuity from good to bad? I know, and those are extremely nebulous terms, but I don't know. Like, do you find yourself thinking of the community as having a sort of spectrum of goodness? How much does this color the filter through which you look at the queer, I don't know, diaspora?
I mean, we can all make moral decisions on like who we think are good and bad people, but we all a lot of it is how good we are at disguising our bad sides or our less pleasant sides. We all have them. I do think perhaps more interesting than like a spectrum for ourselves is thinking about how we have changed in the popular imagination from being sort of disgusting to admirable and what that means. One film I think about a lot actually is I think probably my favorite film is The Birdcage, because it captures that moment of the sort of mid-90s culture wars around homosexuality, especially in the US. But that sort of pivot moment where you do start to see a shift from gay people being standardly portrayed as villains to gay people standardly being portrayed as brave heroes. And I think the film's really interesting because it really deals with I guess for the viewer as well, I think probably for the mainstream viewer at least and the straight viewer, your own complicity in these like systems of feeling weird and disgusted by other people's sexual and gender presentations. I think now it seems like a lot friendlier film than maybe it did when it first came out, because I think maybe when it first came out, the figure of Albert was so much more alive to people as like a something they didn't want to see. Do you know what I mean? Like his becoming lovable is like a really weird bit in the film.
Sure. That there's, I guess, a cultural training that had been happening at that point to react to very demonstrative homosexuality with the sort of disgust, at least in the, in America. There's sort of I don't know, just an assumed hideousness to someone who is that obviously gay. I think that's something we would continue to see a lot of struggling with, and it down to I don't know, people being insulted for being bottoms, like, oh, and there's a lot of misogyny obviously wrapped up in that as well.
I mean, he says it himself at the start of the film, like, I'm a monster. I think that's like a really interesting perception, and I kind of felt like that a lot as a young person.
Do you still feel like that?
Yeah, but I feel differently about feeling like that sometimes. I really like this there's this French mystic. I'm very interested in sort of mysticism and Christian mysticism, and the weird queer aspects of Christian mysticism, especially. My third book is a novel based on the visions of this 11th century Christian mystic nun, a real figure, Hildegard of Bingen. So it's definitely an interest for me, and I'm especially interested in Simone Veil, the sort of 20th century French kind of Catholic mystic who wrote a lot about abjection and disgust and suffering especially. And there's something I draw from her, which is that my therapist very strongly disagreed with, but I really held my guns to, which is that you can be like, well, I'm not disgusting. Other people perceive me as disgusting, but I'm not disgusting. And then you can perceive yourself as being, well, maybe there are elements a bit about me that is disgusting, but I'm lovable despite being disgusting. I'm deserving of love. And then I think at some point for me, maybe only in the last 5 or 10 years, there's some point in me that reached saying, actually, I and other people are deserving of love because we're disgusting. There's something about our humanity and our imperfection and our incompleteness and that actually is good, that to be disgusting is good. It's the fear of the disgusting and the moralization of this of disgust as badness is something that you can overcome in yourself, and it no longer upsets me to think of myself as that. I think we can be monsters, but we can be good monsters.
You know, what I love about that is it reminds me so much of the Frank Kameny popularized slogan, gay is good. It's sort of a variation to gross is great, I guess, or something like that.
Yeah, I'll
Just
take
imagining,
that.
yeah, somebody holding that picket sign.
Because we'll never really get over, I think, some feelings of that objection and disgust. But we can change our response to them. And I still think the fear of the being disgusting and the fear of disgusting people and the desire to remove yourself from it and want to be pure and clean and these sort of things is for me like a terrible force in society and the cause of a lot of pain. And a lot of people feel these instinctive feelings of disgust towards things, and their answer to it is to throw them out, get rid of them. And to me, like as of a lot of I think the culture that formed me, people like John Waters and Janae and stuff, is actually let's rethink our attitude towards disgust in ourselves and other people, and welcome it, and welcome the amazing things that that people who are regarded as monsters and disgusting people can bring to our lives.
So if folks want to check out your books and the podcast and your work, where should they go?
Google me. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't really have much social media presence anymore. I'm on Instagram at Spitz and Productor. I've got my first two books are Chubbs and Red Tory, and then my book on Hildegard is Unknown Language. Or go to badgazepod.com to see the book and the podcast.
Fantastic. Well, Hugh, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Matt. It's been great to talk.
Thanks to Hugh for joining me. Thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the podcast and get back rewards like weekly bonus videos and a care pack in the mail. Check out my new book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. Visit my YouTube channel for stories from behind the scenes of iconic pop culture. Join me for weekly live streams every Sunday on Twitch. And keep up with even more of my work through my weekly newsletter. You can find all that and more at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.